Thank you, Brother Greg, for those songs about the avalanche. I know you're not a mind reader, though. Thank you so much for being with us in our study. We're looking at John 18. You might remember at the last part of our lesson last time, we looked at verse 11. And that's where the Lord said, once again, the cup which the Father has given me, shall I not drink it? And I was thinking about those words. The cup that the Father has given me. And we just read about the betrayal by Judas. Why didn't he say, the cup that Judas has given me, shall I not drink? So I got thinking about that a little bit, and the cup which my Father has given me. And I'm wondering, maybe there are trials, maybe there are problems, maybe there are difficulties that come our way in life that we might attribute to another person, when really, it's a cup that the Lord has given us. Other biblical examples maybe of that. Joseph, sold into slavery by his brothers, drank a bitter cup, the one that his brothers gave him. No, because later, he told his brothers, after the death of their father, you meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. Maybe that's another situation, just like that. The guy that was cursing David, Shimei, one of David's soldiers said, let me just go over there and take his head off. That'll shut him up. And David didn't say, yeah, do that because he's trouble to me. David said, no, don't do that. Maybe this is from the Lord. The Lord has allowed him to utter his cursings in 2 Samuel 16. Maybe it's like the Apostle Paul viewed his chains as not the chains of the Romans, but the chains that the Lord gave him. So maybe that was his cup from the Lord. Just something to think about. And in thinking about that stuff, where do you put your trust? Judas put his trust in an army of police going out to take Jesus. Peter put his trust in the sword that he drew out of his cloak. You know, where do you and I put our trust? In this passage, we'll see that Annas and Caiaphas put their trust in their political power. But you know where the Lord put his trust? In love and devotion to his Father. Maybe you and I could learn something like that. In verse 12, the Roman cohort and the commander of the officers of the Jews arrested Jesus and bound him and led him to Annas first, for he was father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was high priest that year. They came to bind Jesus. And you already know it took a whole lot of people to do that, right? A whole band of people just to bring one guy in. They bound him. Well, let me think about that for a minute. They bound him. No, he was in control of the entire situation. But what was he bound by? You and I know what he was bound by. He was bound by his great love for us. Bound by devotion to his Father. Not those silly little cords that those foolish men put around his hands. Because he gave himself up willingly, remember? We snicker at when we read about Delilah trying to tie up Samson. She didn't know what she was dealing with, did she? What are these guys doing? Binding the Son of God with rope? It's kind of humorous when you think about it, isn't it? The soldiers saw that when Jesus rebuked Peter and told him to put away his sword, that they could do what they were going to do without any kind of interference or any kind of trouble. And so that's exactly what they proceeded to do. Without trouble. They hurriedly take Jesus into custody and they take him to Annas first, John says. Who is this guy? He was not the current high priest. Even though if you combine all the gospel accounts, they call both Annas and Caiaphas high priest. And so you kind of scratch your head a little bit. Wonder what that's all about. What? I thought there was only one high priest. How come these guys are calling two guys the high priest? Well, Annas had been high priest before. Caiaphas was the acting high priest at the present time. How did that happen? Because I always thought that the Jewish custom was when you're a high priest, you're that for life as long as you can function in that capacity and do your job. I thought that was a lifelong thing. But you know, with all the political intrigue and foreigners coming in and taking over and setting up a governor and running things their way, it's pretty easy for us to understand, okay, they didn't like the way Annas was doing things. He wasn't with them all the way, so they took him out and put somebody else in. And maybe it was one of those situations, very well could be, and we're not surprised by it if someone purchased that office from the Romans since they were in control. Do you think it might be something like that? But with all the political confusion, don't you think maybe that could be the case? And maybe it was because Annas was regarded as the legitimate high priest. And Caiaphas, he was just the guy that the Romans put in. Maybe that was the situation. But in any case, Annas would have been a person of great influence and great power because he had occupied the position of high priest. And it very well may be that Annas was the guy who was most interested in capturing Jesus and bringing him in. Why would that be? Who was it that stood to gain by the money changers conducting business in the temple area? And who disrupted that business? And wouldn't a man who felt a sting in his pocketbook be a man who might be looking for a little revenge? And maybe the man who really wanted to be the first one to gloat over his arrest? Do you think that might be the case? Knowing human nature, would you think that would be reasonable? Now, Caiaphas was the one in verse 14 who had advised the Jews that it was expedient for one man to die on behalf of the people. Do you remember that passage when we talked about it? From John 11, 47 through 53, when they were plotting how they were going to arrest Jesus and how they were going to murder him without being in trouble themselves. And Caiaphas told these guys, he said, you guys don't know a thing. You're a bunch of ignorant people. Don't you know that it's expedient for one man to die for the people? Now, what did he mean by that? He meant what we are going to do, as far as I can have anything to do with it, is we're going to do what's expedient. We're not going to follow justice. We're going to do what's expedient. And we're going to get rid of this guy because all of our dreams are going to be crushed if there's a revolution because of what he's doing and the continuing number of believers that he has. And so you have this political intrigue going on all of the time. The gospel record tells us that really what Caiaphas said was a prophetic statement, that one man would die on behalf of all the people. And that sounds like a prophecy about Jesus, doesn't it? So from that day on, they planned together to kill him, is what John told us in chapter 11. And John's reference to that gives us some kind of sense about the ruthless nature of Caiaphas in dealing with Jesus during this trial. So it comes as no surprise to us that he runs roughshod over every law created for justice, equity, and impartiality in order to accomplish the murder of an innocent man that troubled his wickedness. Then, John kind of gives a little interruption to his writing about these guys in verse 15 when he says, Simon Peter was following Jesus, and so was another disciple. Now that disciple was known to the high priest and entered with Jesus into the court of the high priest. But Peter, standing at the door outside, So the other disciple, who was known to the high priest, went out and spoke to the doorkeeper and brought Peter in. So you form a mental picture of what is happening right here. After this initial panic of the disciples when Jesus was arrested in Gethsemane, there were some disciples who calmed their fear and summoned enough courage to follow at a distance to see if they could see what was going to happen to their Lord. John traces the movements of two of them, Peter and an unnamed disciple, which almost surely has to be John. But John doesn't name himself. The familiarity of that disciple, if it is John, with the high priestly family, allowed him access into the proceedings of what was going on. And it ultimately allowed Peter access too when John went to the doorkeeper and said, okay, yeah, he's all right, let him in. And that kind of set up the situation where Peter casually, in the first instance, denies the Lord. Look at verse 17. Then the slave girl who kept the door said to Peter, you're not also one of this man's disciples, are you? He said, I am not. Now the slaves and the officers were standing there having made a charcoal fire, for it was cold and they were warming themselves, and Peter was also with them standing and warming himself. We don't know how much time elapsed between these two verses. Each of the four gospel writers mentions a maid or a servant girl in connection with Peter's first denial. And there's no indication whatsoever that this maiden was attempting in any way at all to harm Peter or to cause him any trouble. She's just scrutinizing him very carefully. And just happens to think, because she knows that John's a disciple, or whoever this other one is, she knows that about him, and he's the one that comes, oh, okay, that guy's okay, let him in. And so a kind of a natural outgrowth of that is, well, you know, are you a disciple of his too? And Peter, no, I'm not. Just as simple as that. Real simple. His denial is a conspicuous evasion. Don't you think? I'm not. Here's a man who had a great amount of courage. Well, how do you know that? Because he was outnumbered in Gethsemane. I don't know how many to one, but he was definitely outnumbered. And the other guys had weapons. And he drew his sword and attempted to mutilate one of the servants of the high priest, probably knowing he was going to lose his life in the battle. So he was a man of great courage. Don't you agree that he was? Yet in this scene, he is intimidated by the innocent question of a servant girl. Does that seem kind of strange? And Peter compounds his problem. You know how? He told one lie. I don't know him. But then when questioned further about it, as we'll notice a little bit later, he tells another lie. And, you know, really that's a big warning for everybody. Once you tell a lie, no matter how small you may regard it, and you may think that's just a quick way to brush somebody off and then I'm all about my business. And you know what? It becomes a whole lot easier to tell that second lie. And there'll be times where you have to tell lies to cover up the lie that you told previously. And then you get to the point where you really need to write down what you tell people because you didn't tell them the truth. And you don't remember exactly what you did tell them. Because you end up telling so many lies, it's difficult to keep up with. You ever know anybody like that? Once you tell one lie, it's really hard to stop. And soon you're riding an avalanche of lies. And it's a slippery slope and you're going downhill. But that's not the only avalanche that's happening here. The Lord's in a big avalanche, isn't he? Because of his familiarity with the high priestly family and with the circumstances of the household, the disciple, if it is John, didn't have anything to fear from any threats from this maiden at the door who knew him to be a disciple. But Peter was a person, if you look at his background, Peter was a person who was not used to rubbing shoulders with the high people in society. He wasn't used to being around lavish circumstances and high-minded people. And the unfamiliarity of those type of circumstances and those surroundings of high society must have added to him his general sense of uneasiness about his circumstance, which contributed to the loss of nerve. You think? So Peter selects a location where maybe he won't be recognized, and maybe nobody will ask him any more questions. And you think, well, how is it that if he's going over to a fire to warm himself, how is it that he won't be recognized because there's this fire going and these flames are up and you can see everybody around the campfire. But the flames weren't flaming up. We're told it was a charcoal fire. Warm, but no big flames coming up. And so, maybe I can warm my hands a little bit, and the light's so low, nobody will recognize me. But that wasn't right, was it? Somebody did recognize him. He probably felt he was on safe middle ground. And it's doubtful that there's any other incident recorded for us in the Scriptures which so perfectly portrays the territory between good and evil, which so many of us can very easily occupy if we're not careful. Peter's attitude on this occasion should enable us to see the despicable attitude of neutrality. I want to ride the fence. I don't want to commit. If I commit too far this way, it'll cause me trouble. If I commit too far this way, it'll cause me trouble. I just want to ride right down the middle. Isn't that what Peter did? And it really turns out that Jesus knew Peter very much better than Peter knew himself. He told him ahead of time, "You're going to deny me." Not once, not twice, three times. At this point, John interrupts the account of Peter's denial in order to report on the proceedings, which were by now taking place inside the palace. Verse 19. The high priest then questioned Jesus about his disciples and about his teaching. But what you're going to notice right here is the Lord says nothing about his disciples. Why? You know, is Jesus still protecting his disciples? I think so. They knew they were really after him. That was really what it was all about. And they questioned him about his teaching. And in verse 20, Jesus answered him, "I've spoken openly to the world. I always taught in synagogues and in the temple where all the Jews come together. And I spoke nothing in secret. Why do you question me? Question those who have heard what I spoke to them. They know what I said." That's a good answer. Annas should have known better. But he probably allowed his desire to kill Jesus to drive him to do what he did. He violated the laws of justice right here by asking an accused man to testify on his own behalf. We don't even do that today, do we? In our court system, do people testify against themselves? And that's precisely what Jesus is reminding him of when he says, "I didn't speak anything in secret. Everything I said was public. Now why don't you ask the people what I said? Why don't you bring forth your witnesses who can testify as to what I said? Why are you questioning me about it?" You know, it's really, you have every right to bring witnesses against me, but you don't really have any right to directly question me about what I said. That's not the right thing to do. And what happened to him because he said that? His answer emphasized the fact that he made no effort whatsoever to cause a tumult among the people, to start a violent revolution, to overthrow the government, to cause these guys any sort of difficulty other than the difficulty that they were already in because they didn't follow God. If he had been that sort of person, would he have been out in public speaking about it? He wouldn't, would he? People who are fomenting rebellion Don't go out in public and start talking about what they're going to do, because what's going to happen to them when they do? A bird is going to fly and put in somebody's ear, and then they're going to come get him, and it's all over, right? So he would have been in secret places, in quiet places, working behind the scenes, undercover, for this great revolution on such and such day. We're going to blow it wide open. That's the kind of situation that it would have been if he were that type of person. Why couldn't these guys see that? Because they weren't interested in the truth. They were interested in one thing. We're going to kill this guy. And we need to do it in such a way that we think it's going to cause us the least amount of trouble to do it. But we're going to do it. That's what they were interested in. Annas was zealously driven to questioning Jesus, hoping to draw some kind of statement from him that might be used against him when the council came together. There were probably several of his underlings were going through the night to their houses, wake them up, get up, we got a meeting, the council is very important, we captured Jesus and we're going to take care of it. Jesus didn't give him that ammunition to use against him, did he? Just to the point, justice was given very little consideration in the course of this effort to rid the public of this wonderful teacher who was causing so much discomfort to the wicked people. And in verse 22, when he had said this, one of the officers standing nearby struck Jesus, saying, "Is that the way you answer the high priest?" Jesus answered him, "If I have spoken wrongly, testify of the wrong," probably as he wiped blood off his mouth. "But if rightly, why do you strike me?" And John says, "So Annas sent him bound to Caiaphas, the high priest." Do you see the frustration in the lives of these guys that are examining Jesus here? When this questioning fails to bring out something that we can legitimately convict him of, in their frustration and in their anger, one of the officials slaps him in the face. It's at this point that it becomes boldly obvious that they're not interested in any kind of justice whatsoever. And however Jesus answers them, they're going to take it as an insult to the priest. And this officer, by taking it upon himself to punish Jesus without the permission or command of the court, made himself judge, jury, and executioner. And that wasn't right. And these guys knew that it wasn't right. He showed the general contempt which he had for the principles of law and justice. And by his not being rebuked for his actions, it displayed the lack of justice and the bulging, inappropriate impartiality on the part of the high priest and all of those who stood on his side. To the mind of this wicked man, it was an act of impertinence to speak up at all in one's own defense when you're being cross-examined and questioned by the high priest, especially when you make a valid point or bring up some principle of righteousness that ought to be respected by these men who were supposed to be standing for the law of God. Right? Here, Jesus' response is powerfully instructive. Think about that a little bit. Why, when he was struck in the face. Why did he say this? What sort of thing is here that I need to think about and try to understand? Because not too long ago, I read in the Sermon on the Mount where Jesus said, do not resist an evil person, but whoever slaps you on the right cheek, turn the other to him also, Matthew 5 and verse 39. But on this occasion, being struck in the face, Jesus didn't say, hit me again. Did he? Why not? Because I remember what he said in the Sermon on the Mount. Did he maybe figuratively turn the other cheek? Repeating the very same statement which got him unjustly struck in the first place? He confronted the injustice of his interrogators. If I have spoken wrongly, testify of the wrong. But if I have spoken rightly, why did you strike me? That should be our guide in responding to evil. Jesus doesn't strike back, but he doesn't let go of that principle of truth and righteousness either, does he? And when people are treating him unjustly and they're sinning against God doing so, he's pointing it out to them. Isn't that figuratively turning the other cheek? Because if somebody's going to hit you for something truth, a statement of truth and righteousness that you make, don't you think when you make it again, they're going to hit you again? Or something worse? If you don't back down? Jesus confronts injustice, but he doesn't resort to injustice himself. And that's really a beautiful model of grace and truth, isn't it? Jesus never had any hope of justice with these guys. Their wickedness was far too overflowing. The self-interest of Annas and his colleagues is exposed. Jesus was condemned before he was even tried. Before they asked him the first question. Before they said the first word, Jesus was condemned. When any man is engaged in an evil way, and his only desire is to crush, eliminate, anyone who opposes him, if he can't do it by fair and righteous means, he'll do it any way he possibly can. He'll do it underhandedly. He'll lie. He'll do all sorts of evil to accomplish what he wants to accomplish. That's these guys, the religious leaders of God's people. Now, John goes back to Peter. And he says, Simon Peter was standing warming himself. So they said to him, you are not also one of his disciples, are you? He denied it and said, I am not. The second time. One of the slaves of the high priest, being a relative, we got family involved now. Being a relative of the one whose ear Peter cut off, do you think he may have been an eyewitness to that? Said, did I not see you in the garden with him? Now, of all the people that were in the garden, it was at night, but they came with lanterns and torches, remember? And all the people in the garden, if you're going to remember anything, you're probably going to remember an act of violence. If you're an eyewitness to it, if you saw the guy pull out a sword and take a swipe at the serf, and especially if he's a relative of yours, right? You're not going to forget that face. Because when the sketch artist from the police department comes to you and says, you didn't describe what this guy looks like, we're looking for him, we're trying to find him. You're going to be able to tell them enough details, you're going to be able to produce a likeness of him, aren't you? Because that image is going to be burned in your mind. Because it happened during an episode of violence. Did I not see you in the garden with him? John says, very simply, in verse 27, Peter then denied it again. And immediately, a rooster crowed. The other gospel writers give a little bit more information. But John says that's enough. Each of the four writers of the Gospels include in their gospel account the Lord's prediction that Peter would deny him three times. Matthew 26, Mark 14, Luke 22, and John 13. And each one of the gospel writers also includes in their record the three acts of denial. The accounts differ in some details, but the accounts do not contradict each other. If you've never failed the Lord, you may stop listening now, because what I'm going to say doesn't have anything to say to you if you have never failed the Lord. But for the rest of us, I trust that this will be encouraging and helpful. The truth is, whether by unchrist-like words, thoughts, deeds, we've all joined Peter in saying, maybe not verbally, I don't know the Lord. I'm not a disciple of Jesus Christ. Undoubtedly, there's a swirl of emotions around Peter at this time, which, if you think about it, we have to sympathize with this man. Certainly, he's concerned about the fate of his Lord. Maybe he's also somewhat resentful and stung by the fact that the Lord rebuked him and told him to put his sword away. We don't handle things that way in the kingdom. He was a little overzealous in his attempt to defend Jesus. I think we know how easy it is for us to sit in judgment on Peter and say, oh, he's just a coward. Denied the Lord when it counted the most. Well, yeah, that's what he did. Should we be careful about uselessly making a target of other men's blunders when you and I have enough blunders to worry about for ourselves? I do, anyway. It would do us a whole lot of good to just ask the question, am I qualified to sit in judgment upon Peter? Even though the gospel records tell us about this huge blunder that he made, this isn't to say that Peter didn't sin. He most certainly did. But it was not because he was a bad man at heart. It wasn't because evil filled his heart. Consider this. Who was the person who would have been the most affected by Peter's denial? Who was it? Wasn't me. Wasn't you. Who was it? It was the Lord. Now, what did the Lord do about it? What did the Lord say about it? Didn't the Lord have ultimate confidence in the whole outcome with Peter as a disciple of his? Didn't he? Early on in the Lord's ministry, he even changed Peter's name to give some kind of meaning as to what he would be like in the kingdom. The outcome of this apostle's life. And to Peter, he said, blessed are you. God has revealed what you just confessed, and I'm going to give you the keys of the kingdom. You're going to give the keys of the kingdom to this coward denier? Yes. It's easy to call Peter a coward. But I'm convinced that most of the people who call him a coward have never faced what Peter faced. How many times your grandmother tell you, or your grandfather tell you, don't judge a man till you walk a mile in his shoes? Maybe that's got something to do with how we should feel about this. We need to keep in mind that he was a follower of Christ, just as you and I claim that we are. And so let us ask what we would have done if we had been in his sandals, in the situation he was in on the night in question. Would we have gone to the high priest's house when the soldiers led Jesus there, or would we have gone into hiding? Would we have been with the other disciples who are heard of only when their fear has passed away? The danger has passed away. It's easy for one to say, I'm a Christian, and to profess that in front of people who might appreciate it and who might regard you as a good fellow because you made that confession. It's kind of easy then, but when that statement means a certain testing where it's not so easy. A little bit different there, isn't it? If that statement, yes, I am a Christian, leads to the sorrow of Gethsemane, the crown of thorns, the lashings on his back, nailed to a piece of wood, you going to confess that now? So we should at least make some kind of effort to learn something of the reasons for this disciple's fall. When we read of his first denial, let us say to ourselves, soul, take heed to yourself. And when we read of his second denial, we may say to ourselves, soul, do not be high-minded, be humble. And when we read of that third denial, even with its additional oaths and curses that John doesn't tell us about, once more, let us say, let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. This account has many things to say to us about the danger of temptation as it comes to us in forms that we don't expect. Our failures may not be as dramatic or as well known as Peter's failure, but whether by our words or our actions, it's still a denial of Christ if we're sinning against God, isn't it? And if Peter, an apostle, who obviously was a committed disciple of the Lord, a loyal follower of Jesus, failed and denied his Lord three times, then surely somebody like me could do the very same thing. It seems as if what is stressed is his failure and shame, but there are other things that we would do well to remember. We would do well to remember that all the other disciples except John, if he's the unnamed disciple, had forsaken Jesus and fled. Peter didn't. Remember Peter's courage. True, he failed, but he failed when he was in a situation that the other disciples didn't want any part of. There's something to be said for that, I think. We must remember how much Peter loved Jesus. True, he failed, but he failed in circumstances where he was trying to do something for his Lord. Circumstances which only a faithful lover of Jesus would have participated in. And we must remember how Peter redeemed himself. The story of his denial would soon get out. People would learn of this tale, and maybe they would use it maliciously against Peter. And maybe they made little sounds of a cock crowing when Peter walked down the street. You know how cruel people can be. But Peter had courage and the tenacity of purpose to redeem himself, and that's exactly what he did. So I don't think it was the real Peter who cracked under pressure. I think it was a moment of weakness when he denied his Lord. And I think that's probably exactly what Jesus could see, because he didn't give up on him. The tremendous thing about Jesus is that beneath all of our failures, he sees our heart. He sees the real person. He sees genuinely who we are and who we want to be, and he understands. And he loves us in spite of our failures. John doesn't mention the Lord's look at Peter and doesn't mention Peter's subsequent sorrow, but it had already been mentioned by the other gospel writers. Thank you for thinking with me about these things surrounding the circumstances of our Lord on this fateful night. If you're in our assembly and John's gospel has created faith in you to where you want to be a disciple of his, and you're going to try to the very best of your ability not to deny your Lord, you're going to confess him before men, repent of your sins, be baptized in water for the forgiveness of sins, and live the life of a Christian to the very best of your ability. And when you mess up, you're going to go to the Lord and you're going to make it right, because that's what his people do. And he's promised to forgive us and to help us all along the way, and we can live with him forever. Does that sound good? We can help you with that tonight. You need to respond to the Lord's invitation. Please do that. Come to the front. Tell me about it. While together we stand and sing the invitation song.